This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World, and our guest today is Paul Kocher, president of Cryptography Research, Inc. Welcome to ETW.
Thanks, Mark.
Could you tell us just a little bit about your background academically and professionally and about the founding of CRI and what the company focuses on today?
Sure. We've been working on hard data security problems, mostly for large companies, for about a decade. I started the company in 1995, and since then we've worked on all kinds of different projects, ranging from wireless infrastructure security projects to helping financial institutions deal with fraud to what we'll be talking about today, which is some of the work that we're doing to help mitigate piracy problems for studios and provide extra value for consumer electronics companies that are making products to work with content.
And pretty much your focus has been on finding the hardest problems and solving them?
Those are the most fun ones to work on, so that's what we tend to gravitate towards.
Okay, tell us anything you want about the company, how big it is, where it is, anything you want to say, is it public or privately held? And so
sure, we're privately held. We're located in San Francisco. We have about 10 full-time people who are focusing exclusively on hard security problems, and then we bring in contractors to do most of our engineering work. So the number of people we have here varies depending on what day of the week it is.
It's kind of a virtual corporation in the model of the 90s.
Well, we have a good full-time staff as well.
Right.
And we've been profitable every year since we were founded.
Okay. Mostly we're going to talk today about self-protecting digital content, which is something I found in my searches about the web. You're pretty much in charge of developing and evangelizing for. Can you tell us what self-protecting digital content is?
Sure. So let me first say what problem we're solving, and then
okay.
I'll describe how we do it.
Okay.
When you look at the situation with piracy today, Hollywood studios, in the case of movies, suffer the losses when there's piracy. But the people who make the products that work with movies decide how much money is going to get spent on security and how good a job, how strong that security is going to be. So you have this fundamental economic problem where the studios are suffering losses, but other companies are deciding what their risk should be.
Which other types of companies are these?
Well, for example, companies that make players that play movies for consumers or make computer software that manipulates movies.
And they don't lose money. They make money if they sell a digital video recorder or a DVD player.
Right. The only time when it really matters for the consumer electronics companies is right when they're first establishing a format.
Right.
But if you take, for example, DVD players today, there's no effort that consumer electronics companies make to try to make the most secure DVD player. In fact, some of them do exactly the opposite. They go and they try to make the region coding very easy to hack.
Okay. We're going to get back, I think, in more detail about the importance of that. Okay, so that's the problem. Set the stage a little bit by talking about how big this piracy threat is in its own terms and what it could lead to.
Well, so the people's estimates of how bad the piracy problem is vary widely. Some recent numbers suggested there are about $3 to $4 billion a year of lost revenue just for the major Hollywood studios because of copying.
What kind of percentage of their overall grosses is that?
I actually think some of those numbers are a little high. My guess is right now they're probably losing somewhere around 10% of their revenues to piracy domestically. But what's important isn't what the piracy rates are today, it's where they're going to be in the future, because computers are going to get faster, networks are going to get faster, hard disks are going to get bigger, and all of these technologies are improving exponentially.
In fact, what they're kind of doubling their power every 18 months, if you'd say. They're following Moore's Law.
Yes, and in fact, hard disks and network speeds improve faster than Moore's Law. So if you go forward 10 years, those impediments to copying are going to be completely gone. You're going to be able to get a consumer hard disk and put every movie that Hollywood's ever released in high definition on it. You're going to have the network bandwidth in order to copy those movies if you're a pirate.
So and that's a kind of inexorable progress towards more capacious disks and faster networks.
Absolutely, and it's a wonderful thing for everybody, including the studios, and that they're going to have new ways to distribute their movies, and it's a great thing for consumers. It's also a great thing for pirates, though. So it's important for the studios to do something beyond what they're doing today in order to be prepared for this.
Okay, now there's a very good article about from Bloomberg that's going to be linked to on this page that talks about you and other people's efforts in the anti-piracy area. One point that's made in there is that this kind of piracy is going to put the kind of lower, less efficient studios out of business, leading to consolidation, leading presumably to less choice in product, both for honest people and pirates.
Yeah, what I would expect to see happen first is that the art films and other marginal projects that are barely profitable to begin with get cut, as studios will try to be focusing on the revenue-generating efforts, the blockbusters. And then over time, the talent will get squeezed, the things like special effects budgets will get squeezed. And gradually, I mean, you'll just see the industry going through the typical patterns that you would expect for an industry under stress.
So, in fact, there could be a severe, noticeable, and almost catastrophic deterioration of the quality of the content of filmed entertainment or digital entertainment due to this problem.
Well, that's sort of the worst. That's the worst case scenario.
Right.
There are a lot of smart people, ourselves included. At least I think we're smart.
Right.
Who are working on this problem, and we're certainly not the only ones who are working on various aspects of the piracy issue. So, if nothing gets done in the next few years, then you're going to start seeing these problems happen a few years after that. But to Hollywood's credit, everybody that we talk to in Hollywood recognizes the severity of the problem. I mean, you can go and look at the messages coming out of the MPAA, and every single one of the studio chiefs has talked about piracy as one of the most, if not the most, severe problem facing the industry. So the recognition is there. The will to fix the problem is there. Right now, the big question is, how do we build technology that can mitigate some of these problems? And that's what we're working on.
Okay. Well, why don't you talk about what the sort of legacy approach is now and what the responsibilities of the CE, the consumer electronics people, are, and what the responsibilities of the studios are, and how that impacts on the piracy situation. And then we can go on to talk about how your new approach would change that.
Sure. Right now, if you go buy a DVD player or a DVD audio player, or you go and you download Windows Media Player, some vendor who is not a Hollywood studio has written some security software to go in that device. And over time, we're going to see a lot more sophistication in those security components in order to accommodate features like transferring content to portable devices.
Right.
The problem that everybody has, though, is that when you build, for example, a DVD player, the software for that security and everything else gets baked into the player when it's manufactured. So if there's any bug in there, that bug is going to be with that device for the rest of its life. From a security perspective, this is a really big problem, though, because it means that if that bug compromises the security of the content going through the device, any buggy device in the entire world can potentially compromise the entire set of movies that Hollywood owns.
Because it only needs to be ripped once.
Right, and not only it has to be ripped once, but in addition to that, the security software never changes, so that if there is a problem, that problem is going to exist forever.
Right. Now, whose security software never changes? The security software in the consumer electronics device?
Exactly.
Okay.
So it's baked into the device when it's manufactured.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do, and the systems that we're building, change this model. So let me talk a little bit about the differences between the current approach and what we're doing.
Right.
So with today, as I was saying before, you have this software that's getting written by a consumer electronics company who really doesn't have much of an economic incentive to invest a lot in security. And then they're putting this software, which is typically buggy, into devices where it can never be changed. And to fix this, what we're doing is putting the security software on the media to be distributed with the content. And in particular for formats like HD DVD, this security software can be written for a simple virtual machine that would be part of the standard and be part of the player, and it will run inside the player when the disk's first inserted to check for attacks that are in progress and to fix security bugs.
So that means that the consumer electronics manufacturers need only provide for the virtual machine within their hardware, and everything else will be taken care of by software that's on the DVD.
Exactly. So it greatly reduces the costs for the consumer electronics companies because they don't need to go and write tons of security software and debug it.
Right.
So it does increase the costs for the studios because they now have to go to the effort of writing the security software. But this is a cost that they're happy to take on because if they weren't going to do it, nobody else would.
And in fact, it establishes a free market in that particular process. The studios that want to invest in more in it and do it better will benefit by having less piracy.
Exactly, and that's what we're trying to do, is to fix that economic model so that the studios can choose how much they want to spend in security and make security decisions for themselves.
Okay, so walk us through in practice when this system's in place, who will be in charge of what? What will the DVD player makers do, and what will the studios do, and how will they do it, and what will be the sequence for that?
Well, so it would look a lot like the way it is today, except that the task of writing and managing the security software would be offloaded from the consumer electronics companies to the studios.
Right.
And actually, in practice, it wouldn't be the studios that would do it, but they would outsource that
right.
to independent companies like IBM Global Services or Technicolor are examples of companies that are actively involved in providing technology support studios.
What can you say? Will all of those on-the-disk security procedures be essentially the same, or will there be drastically different versions of how that problem can be solved from that perspective?
Well, so there's a lot of flexibility in terms of how that can be implemented in the same way there's a lot of flexibility about how you're going to write a word processor.
Right.
But in practice, what you'd expect to have happen is the studios would begin with something simple and wait until there's a piracy problem, and then when that problem comes along, whatever it might be, put a countermeasure out that addresses it. So if somebody finds a bug in a particular player type, put code on subsequent releases that detects that player type and addresses the weakness.
And the fact is that people won't need to replace their players because it'll just have the virtual machine on it, and the studios, each time they issue another release, can of course learn from their mistakes and produce more secure disks.
Exactly, and if you look at the sort of legacy approach that people have taken to security, you have this problem that you mentioned of revocation. So the traditional approach is one where the studio can have some control over whether or not their content will play on particular players, but they have no way of the studios have no way of knowing which devices have been hacked if a vulnerability has been found by pirates. So if a particular player type has been found to be insecure, the studio's choice at that point is either put out their title with no protection against that weakness, in which case piracy is inevitable, or they can put out their content so it won't play on any of the affected players, in which case the consumers who bought the insecure devices but haven't done anything wrong are out of luck and they wouldn't be able to play the movie. So both of those options are extremely unattractive. But by moving the security software onto the media, we're able to give studios a third option, which is to fix the problem and allow it to play in all the consumers' machines.
Because the bugs on the machines won't have any impact now.
Right, or the bugs can be fixed. There are different things that can be different kinds of security flaws you can have, and the way you address those depends on the particular type of the flaw.
Okay. How does digital rights management, or DRM, figure into this, if it does?
DRM means so many different things to different people, that's a hard question to answer.
Right. In the sense that it would require passwords to view content, it would set parameters about the time, you know, you can only watch it during the day or something, you can only watch it until the end of July, you can't watch it until the end of July, or things like that.
So this approach is sort of agnostic as to whether studios would implement those sorts of things. My personal belief is that consumers want to basically buy the content and be able to watch it and don't want to worry about trying to figure out whether it expires in July or August. So I'm not necessarily convinced that there's a business case for those kinds of features, but if what we're doing is really independent of what a studio might decide to do there.
Okay. We've been talking essentially about system architecture here. Where does the cryptography come in?
So there's cryptography that sits in several different aspects of a system like that, like this. It's something that's under the hood where a consumer would never see it, but there is some cryptographic support that's necessary to have in the player in order for it to have the ability to authenticate its information to the content. So there's this process that goes on where the content checks out the player and gathers information about it, and the player includes some cryptography to enable that process. In addition, there's some fairly sophisticated cryptography that gets used to provide some features like the ability for content to store information in the player, but to do so in a way that if you have a maliciously written or buggy disk that gets played, it won't affect the player in any kind of a negative way. the white paper that's on our website, and I think will be linked with this interview, provides more information about how some of that works.
Okay. Distinguish between amateur and professional media thieves and how their experiences may differ with self-protecting digital content.
Well, so when you're looking at piracy, there's this continuum from people who are really unsophisticated amateurs who just want to make a quick copy to give to a friend, for example. Then at the other extreme, you have people whose sole motivation is profit. When you're looking at the hardcore professionals, there is no affordable technology that can be put into consumer electronics devices that will reliably stop them. So when you're dealing with the hardcore element, you're always going to need to have police and law enforcement involved. But when you're dealing with particularly people who are just looking to download something off the Internet to make copies and sort of the equivalent of the DVD-X copy type software, that type of piracy can be addressed through systems like this. And what that really leaves the studios the flexibility to do then is to go after the hardcore pirates with their resources. Today you've got this problem, which, for example, that you can see really clearly with the recording industry, where they have so many people copying their content, and it's so easy to copy, that you have 12-year-olds doing it, you have, grandmas doing it, people that you can't realistically go and prosecute in large numbers. So by putting a bar in place that's enough to stop people who aren't professionals, it makes it so the remaining people who are participating in piracy can realistically be prosecuted.
Okay, and it frees up that energy to concentrate on the big perpetrators.
Exactly.
What we've been talking about is for the protection of physical media, like DVDs. Is there some applicability of this scheme for protecting online content delivered online?
It could be used there, but for content that's delivered online, you have typically in that situation a PC, which itself is online and can. So if there is a security flaw, you can have the user update their software on the PC. So you don't have the same standards challenges as you have with physical optical media, where you have to lock down the standard and then has to live with it for essentially the indefinite future after that.
Okay. Where does this technology that you've developed, this has been pretty much your idea, and Cryptography Research Inc. has been the sole proponent of it, or is it an industry-wide phenomenon now?
Well, so the technology was developed by researchers here. So we've got a research team that's always looking at emerging security problems and trying to look for solutions to them. In terms of the deployment process, right now we have strong support from many of the studios, and we're working with consumer electronics companies and the standard-setting efforts like the DVD Forum to get this actually standardized as part of future formats.
So is the critical task now to get the CE, consumer electronics manufacturers, to adopt this approach and put the virtual machines on their boxes?
Well, so right now there's something of a game where the consumer electronics companies are trying to figure out what the cheapest and easiest security approaches that the studios will accept might be.
Right.
And the studios are trying to figure out how much they can realistically demand from the consumer electronics companies. And you add on top of that your usual mix of Hollywood politics and communications getting lost in translation, since you've got many of these companies in Japan, Korea, the U.S. It's a very international process. So out of this sort of chaotic political mess, eventually a standard has to emerge.
Is it going to emerge through little bits here and there? It seems to me you have to have a summit of all the CE people and all the Hollywood people and have them reach a decision so they could go forward. Otherwise, because you can't use the scheme that you've set up for the discs unless you've got the players ready to use it.
Exactly.
And you can't play them unless they've got it, if the CE people do it. So how is that? You need a big bang kind of meeting, it seems to me.
Well, there's a lot of different meetings that go into this rather than one large one.
Right.
My company's a principal member of the DVD Forum,
right.
And so we're working through that process.
Does the DVD Forum include manufacturers as well as studios?
Yes.
So it's presumably there at the DVD Forum where something will be worked out?
That's where the security is going to get decided for the HD DVD format. there's a competing format effort that's being led by Sony currently, which is called Blu-ray, and they're in the process now of forming a forum that will be roughly analogous to the DVD forum, but that's not officially in place yet.
Does that mean we could have a repetition at the at a higher level of technology between Beta and VCR again, VHS again?
Absolutely. There's definitely a format war brewing, and at this point, it's too early to say which of these horses is going to win.
Now, Sony, of course, is a studio as well as a consumer electronics producer, isn't it?
Yep.
So
and
do they compete with themselves, and they should be able to at least be able to cooperate with themselves?
They generally do, although when you're dealing with a company as large as Sony,
right,
obviously you have differing opinions internally, as would any large company.
Right.
So it's a reasonably complicated process across the whole industry.
Okay, what kind of timetable do you see for some kind of consensus to emerge, if one will or does?
We're at least hoping that there will be some solid decisions made about the security for the format before the end of this year, and that there are people that would like to see players available for Christmas 2005, but I don't think that's a realistic schedule. I think we're looking more likely at 2006 or possibly 2007.
Okay, now if that is done and a self-protecting digital content format is established on a preponderance of the systems, how secure will the content be then?
Well, So the problem that we're looking at isn't so much the question of giving measurable security, but more making it so that when there is a problem, you can fix it.
Right.
So it's essentially certain that there will be attacks that people will discover, no matter what security system gets adopted, whether it's ours or somebody else's. What sets what we're doing apart is that after that happens, it's possible to issue your new titles so that they aren't vulnerable to those old attacks.
So in fact, it's a self-correcting system overall as well as self-protecting.
Right. So We're not necessarily preventing the attacks from occurring. It's just too much complexity, too many companies involved. It's just we're focusing on what you do after a problem occurs.
How does what we've been talking about here fit in with the move towards trusted computing and the creation of more security by installing security features in the hardware in the end user's machine?
That's a relatively separate effort. Those efforts right now are something that could be used by the techniques that we're describing, but they're really completely independent from a technology perspective.
Okay, because in this Bloomberg report, it says encryption specialists like Kocher are just one weapon the studios are marshaling to defend off pirates. They're pushing consumer electronics companies to add security features to DVD recorders and personal computers.
Mm-hmm.
That's more or less referring to the virtual machine rather than putting in some of the chips and other standards of trusted computing?
Well, so there are efforts to do all these different things. So the virtual machine-based approaches that we're working on are one part of the studios' strategies. In addition, you have some studios that are working in techniques like watermarking to try to prevent, for example, camcording in theaters. You also have studios that are working with various kinds of internet strategies to try to mitigate the peer-to-peer downloading problem and prevent a Napster for movies from coming along.
Does watermarking figure at all in self-protecting digital content approach?
Well, so there are two forms of watermarking, and we actually enable something which is different from the usual form of watermarking, so let me explain that briefly.
Sure.
The conventional way that people have tried to use watermarking in anti-piracy systems is to try to put a mark into audio or video data where then a detector in consumer devices will see that mark and refuse to allow copying or will refuse to allow playback if it's playing off recordable media.
Sort of offloading the moral choice to the machine.
A little bit. The problem with this is that if somebody knows how that mark detector works, they can write software to scrub the mark out. So
right,
there's a security challenge there that hasn't been solved yet with that kind of watermarking.
All right.
What we're doing is a little different. With the approach where you have a virtual machine there, what that virtual machine outputs, i.e. the movie that gets displayed, can be slightly different on each different playback device. And so those differences can then be analyzed by the studio if they recover a pirate copy to figure out which machine it came from. What's nice about this is it makes it so that after a crime has occurred, you can go back and use these forensic marks to figure out which devices were involved in perpetrating it, so that you can then prevent your future movies from playing on those devices.
In terms of a genre of machines or specific machines?
Specific machines, so down to the serial number.
Meaning that the virtual machine will brand the content with the number of the machine that's, the identifiable number of the machine that's playing it.
Exactly.
And then once it makes its way into illegal commerce, it can be analyzed to show exactly which machine it was that played it when it was first ripped.
Right. And what's nice about this is that the only way that the studio actually gets information about who was involved in that process is by recovering a pirated copy. So we're tying the collection of information to a crime. So there's no privacy issue for legitimate consumers who aren't making copies, or even for people who make copies where the copy is never recovered by a studio. But as soon as the copy gets posted online, a studio downloads it. Then they can go back and figure out where that came from.
So if you want to make a copy and take it to your house in Connecticut from your house in California, you're okay. But if you make a copy and start duplicating it, and it's caught, you'll be found out.
Right. So we're now addressing this problem that people who participate in piracy often have this sense of anonymity. Psychiatrists call this de-individualization.
Right.
People have this mob mentality where they feel anonymous and they're willing to do things that they wouldn't normally do. By making it so that pirate copies can be traced, we're making it so that now somebody's going to realize that, okay, if I go and make this copy and I post it online, when this copy gets recovered by the studio, they're going to have evidence for prosecuting me, and they can shut off my equipment.
Is that feature included in the system as you've now devised it?
Yes. So actually, this gets implemented as part of the software that the studio writes that is title-specific. So the marking techniques aren't something that are standardized. It's simply a capability that the studio can choose or not choose to put in each title.
So in fact, if they wanted to send out trailers or a DVD full of trailers that they wanted everyone to see, they just wouldn't include that feature.
Sure, and they can turn off all the security features if they want for something like a trailer. And a different model where you would actually have much more aggressive security would be the situation where you're sending out screeners to, for example, members of the Academy. There you would only allow your disc to play on devices that belong to Academy members, so that if somebody steals a disc out of the post, for example, they're not going to be able to decrypt the movie.
Or specifically, that only play on the specially prepared DVD players of particular Academy members.
If you like, yeah.
Right.
So you can tie it down as much as you want to.
Okay. Any final things you want? I've got questions on one or two other peripheral issues, but I'd like you to say anything final that you want to say about self-protecting digital content and what you think it offers the entertainment community.
Well, just to summarize, I mean, what we're trying to do here for the studios is preserve that release window and give them an opportunity with each new title to have reduced security, especially when it's first released. To set expectations, we're not going to eliminate piracy. Nobody's ever going to be able to do that. We're looking at this as a risk management problem, where if we can keep piracy rates lower, we're providing a significant benefit.
Essentially the same way credit card companies keep fraud to a minimum through risk management techniques.
Exactly. You're never going to get rid of credit card fraud. You're just going to keep it under control.
Okay. Thanks for explaining self-protecting digital content to us. Let me ask you just to comment shortly on one or two other things that I've seen you've been involved with. What about DRE, direct recording electronic voting, otherwise known as touchscreen voting? What's your view on that? A day doesn't go by that there isn't a lawsuit or an announcement or some problem or proposed solution to that problem. What do you think about that from a cryptographic or a general point of view?
Well, voting is a tough security problem because there have been all kinds of different attacks against voting systems, and it's not something where there's any ideal voting system out there that's invulnerable to fraud.
Is that because no one's smart enough to build one, or that there are intractable problems that, just as we've been talking really here about fraud or piracy in digital media, are there similar intractable human or technical or both problems that make it impossible to build a completely secure voting machine?
Well, there's the fundamental problem that you have to be able to, for example, detect if somebody is authorized to vote in a particular precinct and,
right,
and authenticate who that person is.
Right.
So when you have there's the joke that in Chicago the dead vote early and often.
Right.
There is an attack where it's not really any technology that can easily tell whether the person who's coming in to vote and claiming to be Joe Blog really is Joe Blog or might be somebody else. And the techniques that you could consider there, like biometrics, create other problems, like privacy issues for people.
Right.
So there are some problems that you can't solve, but now when you look at elections, what you're really trying to do is to prevent mass fraud.
So it's kind of the same way you're trying to prevent mass piracy.
Yes. It's also a risk management problem where your goal is to keep the elections as honest as you possibly can and prevent somebody who, you know, would normally have 40% of the vote from winning. When you look at an election like what happened with the presidential election in Florida in 2000, there you had such a close election that the system started breaking down. And there's going to be no technology that's going to be perfect in those really, really tight elections.
Because that margin of error is always going to be 3, 2, 3, 4%.
Well, it shouldn't be 3 or 4%. It should be well below 1%.
Okay.
But when you're looking at a couple of hundred votes out of millions,
right,
you're in the very, very small fraction of a percent.
So you're below the margin of error, in fact.
Right. Now, when you go electronic, you have this problem that all of a sudden there are all kinds of new failure modes.
Right.
If you look at the complexity of an ordinary, for example, optical paper-based balloting system,
right,
the failure modes there tend to be physical kinds of things that would go on at an individual precinct. So
the paper jams.
For example, now you might lose a vote or you might have to have somebody get involved.
Right.
You could have a dishonest poll worker who's stuffing the ballot box a little bit.
Right.
But you can't have somebody who's going to swing 10% of the votes in a state like Florida through those kinds of attacks.
Right.
But when you go electronic, all of a sudden there are these centralized failure modes where if the machines that are doing that are running the election aren't honest. First of all, there's no way to easily detect that because the dishonesty in the machine can be configured in ways that your tests for correctness won't detect them. And they can also, because these machines are very widely deployed, it means you can have a huge effect across an entire election. So by swinging a few percent of the votes on each machine, you can have a absolutely massive effect overall on the elections.
So it's interesting. Let me ask you to get, before I ask you about internet voting, we've got Homeland Security, we've got fraud and piracy in media, we've got electronic voting. It looks to me like security and encryption and all these issues are taking on a more and more prominent role in American life, are they?
I think so. I mean, if you look at the general trend is toward moving all kinds of processes that used to be done on paper and in person into the electronic world. And as soon as you go electronic, there's this immediate question of how do you secure things.
Because the same thing you just said about votes applies to, for example, money. If it used to be if you wanted to rob a bank, you'd have to go in and take the paper and run out. But if you've got an electronic means for redirecting the flow of cash, you can steal far bigger amounts with far less risk to yourself in terms of risk management for thieves.
Yep. So in all these situations, I mean, you're talking about the sorts of areas where my company is very busy trying to keep problems like bank fraud and credit card fraud under control, managing piracy, trying to help companies protect communications. I mean, all of these are extremely difficult security problems for which there's no perfect low-cost solution. So
and
you end up
right.
with these risk management, harm reduction type efforts.
In fact, these are all more or less global issues as well because people don't care where they are and where the money is that they're stealing it, or the votes might be a little more specific, and the media certainly is a global process.
Well, even elections are a global issue because if you look at foreign governments, there are a lot of governments that would like to influence U.S. elections,
right.
for example. So
right.
It's also an international issue in that all of a sudden you're exposed to people who are operating out of jurisdictions where American law doesn't apply. So when you're dealing with problems like modern credit card fraud and modern piracy, you typically have international organizations that are behind the problems.
And people are going to gravitate to the place where the local laws are the most conducive to their setting up shop, presumably, if they're going to cause trouble.
Exactly. And you can see this with spam, for example, where there's an awful lot of fraudulent spam that comes out of countries like Nigeria because there's essentially no enforcement there.
So in fact, there's kind of a world war going on, isn't there, between banks, movie studios, governments, and a loosely knit group of people out there trying to break into the system.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would describe it so much as a war as a ongoing skirmishes.
Okay.
But it's certainly a big problem, and it's getting worse because of the additional applications of technology in places where things didn't used to be very high-tech.
Overall, what would you recommend, what do you recommend to your clients as a strategy for coping with this? And do you have any suggestions sort of in terms of social policy, education, general social attitudes that might make it easier for the side with all the films, votes, and money to keep them?
Well, the approach that we take is to try to simplify things as much as possible.
Okay.
Because whenever you have really complicated systems, it becomes extremely difficult to know whether there are problems or not. And even worse than that, when something is really complicated, there are a lot more things that can go wrong.
Right.
So, for example, one of the things that we do internally in my company to try to keep our computer network secure is that we have one computer for the people use for connecting out to the internet that doesn't have any interesting information on it,
right,
and a separate computer which isn't connected out, which is used for managing client data.
Right.
It's a very simple approach. There's nothing high-tech about it at all.
Do you transfer data on floppy disks or zip drives?
Thumb drives. So flash.
I'm sorry, which kind of drives?
Thumb drives are little things that plug in the USB port of a computer that you can copy a file on.
So when it's appropriate, you can take data that comes in from the outside and put it on the internal network and vice versa?
Yeah, you can carry it across between the networks, but there's no electronic communication between them.
Okay.
And so that's an example where we've taken a security problem which would normally be very complicated. We have lots and lots of software in these PCs that we would need to lock down, complicated networks, and we've turned that complicated problem into a very simple one. With what we're doing with piracy, it's the same kind of a strategy where what we're doing is taking what would be a very, very complicated security system that's baked into the players when they're manufactured and replacing it with a very simple execution environment and then allowing the studios to put whatever security software they want into there.
Right, that certainly makes sense. How's that working for you, the separating things physically, essentially, between the internal and external communications?
It's a little bit of a hassle, but it's much easier to do that than to any of the alternatives.
Okay. Is the concept of transparency at all related to the concept of simplicity in this context, of making parts of the architecture of systems clear to everyone, but reserving the content of the algorithms to the people who are entitled to them?
Well, so you want to have at least the people who are relying on the security of a system to understand how it works.
Right.
And so in the case of an election, that means that each of the voters and the candidates needs to have at least an intuitive way of grasping that the system is going to work the way that it should. So you can't have extremely complicated voting systems and also have this kind of confidence because you're dealing with people who aren't individually going to be able to spend the time to do things like code reviews.
Right.
When you're dealing with something like our networks, similarly, the relying parties are largely ourselves and our customers, and because it's so simple, again, it's easy for somebody to look at it and see, okay, this is how it works, and this makes sense.
Can these things be kept simple enough that everyone who has to can understand them, or are we in some kind of danger here of essentially having to create a coterie of cryptographers who protect us and have them face off against the anti-cryptographers who are trying to get into everything? And the people are just sort of, they're reduced to cheering one side or the other, but they really don't understand what's going on?
Well, there are some problems where the mathematics are, to be honest, too complicated for anybody to understand who isn't spending a good portion of their time working on those problems.
Right.
So, for example, what actually goes into building an encryption algorithm or an encryption protocol is too complicated for most people to understand.
Right.
But at the same time, once you've got somebody who's built a protocol like that, other people can use that without necessarily understanding all the details of how it works, but can rely on the opinions of people who do.
Okay.
A good example of this is that when you, for example, take your web browser and you connect to a website like Amazon, and you're going to enter your credit card number in, there's a lock symbol that shows up on the browser that means that a protocol called SSL is being used. And this is a protocol that I designed for Netscape 5 or 10 years ago.
Right.
And so,
what's it called?
Called SSL.
Version?
Version 3, or so it's Secure Sockets Layer is the full name for
it. Okay.
And so that protocol describes the mathematics and the procedures that are used by each of the computers, the server and the web browser, to derive some encryption keys and use those to encrypt and authenticate the data that's going back and forth. Now, anybody who wants to can go and download a complete description of how that protocol works, can look at it, can try attacking it, can probe it for problems. It's a completely open book. I don't know how to attack it and break it, even though I designed it, because it's something where the design follows standard principles and uses components that have been widely reviewed.
Right.
So there we're in a situation where you as a user may not have actually gone and read this protocol and understood it, but even though you don't necessarily understand all the details, you can go and read papers written by lots of different people who have analyzed my design and have commented on it and reached various conclusions about it and make it your conclusions based on that.
Okay. Now, you talked about some of the problems with DRE or touchscreen voting. What about Internet voting? And in particular, if you're familiar with it, the Pentagon Serve program, which was intended to be used by up to 100,000 overseas voters, mostly in the military, in November of this year, but was shut down at the end of January because of a report that came out that said the internet makes it impossible to build a secure remote internet voting system, and it will be that way for the foreseeable future, and this system certainly won't work.
So, actually, to clarify a little bit, it wasn't necessarily that the internet was secure that the report concluded
okay.
Made this a bad
so
idea.
So you read the report?
Yes.
That makes two of us.
Computers
then.
At the end points
right.
Are too difficult to be sure that those are secure and bug-free.
Was that what the problem was, the end devices?
Exactly. So if you're trying to use, for example, a web browser for a voting system or even custom software running on a PC,
right.
The question then is how can you be sure that that PC isn't going to have any security bugs in it?
Okay.
Now, if you look at what goes on with Microsoft's operating systems, for example, they keep discovering a new security bug every few weeks.
Right.
So clearly, even if they've patched all the bugs that have been found so far, that you still can guess, okay, there's been hundreds of bugs discovered in the past. It's essentially certain that there will be more.
Right.
So you know then that you're dealing with a system which is insecure.
Meaning that some people know of some of those bugs that haven't been publicly released revealed yet, and they could use it to violate the system, presumably. If they
right. Or if somebody wants to violate the system, they can go hunting for a bug
right.
That Microsoft hasn't discovered yet.
Right.
And clearly, if you're the government or some well-funded entity that's interested in influencing elections or doing something else nefarious,
right.
The cost of going and looking for a bug is pretty low compared right. To other things that you might try to do, like send spies over and work in some other country.
Risk management again, cost-benefit analysis.
Well, and here the way that you manage the risk is by just not exposing yourself to it. So in this situation, they decided that the Internet voting effort simply couldn't be made secure enough.
Or as it says in Henry IV, the discretion is the better part of valor, I guess they decided. Do you believe that it's theoretically impossible to build a secure Internet voting system, or a remote Internet voting system?
We don't know how to do it today. And so, and anybody who's saying that they know how to do it had better have a really good explanation, but because the security technology needed to provide assurance that there are no bugs simply isn't available right now.
Would the deployment of trusted computing in one form or another make it easier to build an internet voting system that was secure?
Well, so if you had trustworthy computers where the word trustworthy meant that you actually could provide people confidence that there were no security bugs,
right.
That would be a very useful step to have.
Would the internet as a network be secure enough to use with those trusted machines?
Well, so when you're building a security protocol like SSL, for example,
right.
It's built with the assumption that the communication network that's being used is completely malicious.
Okay.
So that,
right.
That essentially once the data leaves one computer, everything between that machine and the other is being controlled by the adversaries.
Or is wide open to sniffing and every kind of thing like that.
Exactly. And clearly the people who are the adversaries can prevent communications from happening at all. They can cut the connection.
Right.
But the protocols are designed so that assuming the cryptography is sound, which is a pretty reasonable assumption,
right.
And assuming that the software in each of the machines is bug-free, which is often not a reasonable assumption, but
right.
if we make those two assumptions, we'll end up with secure communications provided a few other requirements have been met.
Secure meaning that the messages received can be validated as the right messages coming from the right people. Is that right?
Right. So you're providing to two or three different kinds of security here. You want to authenticate one or both of the machines that's communicating. So when you go to Amazon, your browser will do some checks to make it so that to make sure that the keys it's receiving from the remote server correspond to the domain name that's in the URL.
So it essentially checks to see what the server it's talking to says it is, and then it goes to the repository of the keys and checks, and then it can assure itself that it is in fact Amazon.
Yeah, actually, in practice, there isn't a repository of keys, but there's a set of procedures involving public key cryptography that are used.
Okay.
Then once that's been done, there's the actual content of the web pages and the credit card numbers that go back and forth, or whatever it is that the data exchange that follows. Cryptography is used to protect the privacy of that data. So
right.
If somebody is recording it or sniffing the sniffing the traffic, they won't be able to tell what was said.
Right.
In addition, cryptography is used to make sure that the data isn't tampered with, so that
right.
The data that gets sent is the data that is received.
Good old non-repudiation.
Actually, SSL doesn't provide non-repudiation.
Ah.
That's a slightly different problem, which is making it so that a third party who is watching the transaction could verify that neither party was lying about what the other said.
Okay.
There's some good reasons why SSL doesn't do that.
All right. It could be added, couldn't it, as a function if someone
it could. That creates a whole new can of security challenges that
right.
that protocol was not designed to
okay.
address.
Okay. With all of these benefits and power that you just described for SSL, couldn't an internet voting system that would ride on top of it for the exchange of information and votes instead of money and books be equally well protected? And if that's true, maybe that's not that may still not be good enough for government work in this case.
Well, so the problem you have is twofold. One is that for voting systems, you have to have very high confidence that there are no bugs.
Right.
And with credit cards, if you have a bug, you find out about it because somebody commits credit card fraud.
Right.
And then you go and you fix it.
Right.
With elections, you don't have any feedback like this. The candidate who should have won loses the election.
Right.
A different candidate wins. But there's no audit trail. There's no merchant. There's no bank, for example, involved that will recognize that some money has been stolen.
Isn't there a way to, for example, issue voters a kind of passcode and then take all of the ballots and post them on a huge spreadsheet? And then the same way students go to see how they did on their finals and check it according to their secret number so that no one else knows what grades they got, couldn't all the voters then go to that website and check to see that the spreadsheet expresses the votes that they cast and that they identify with their code number were correct, and then complain if they weren't, and in fact use the spreadsheet on individual computers to add up the totals and see that both everyone's votes were cast the way they expected them to be and that the totals were honestly added up?
There's been a lot of research in cryptography toward building systems like that, and
right.
In practice there's some additional steps that you need, but making those workable ends up being quite difficult because, for example, with what you just described, somebody could show to a third party how they voted,
yes,
which
would
allow vote selling,
right.
Which is a significant problem
All
that
right.
voting systems try to prevent.
Another problem. Okay, well, enough about voting for now. Let me ask you one more question and then a kind of interesting one as well. What's quantum encryption, and when will it be available, and how does it work, and what will it add to this whole mix?
Okay, so there are actually two things, quantum encryption and quantum computing. People often confuse.
All right, don't clear it up.
Quantum encryption is a method for using something called entanglement to send messages from one place to another in a way where there's some quantum mechanical explanation as to why the communication should be secure. I don't think it's going to ever be a significant or practical technique for ordinary kinds of communications, simply because it requires that you have a dedicated connection from one device to another device that's communicating. So you can't have a switched network like the internet.
Okay.
Now, quantum computing is a different area of research, which involves building computers that don't follow the ordinary rules of conventional machines. A conventional computer does a sequence of simple computations one after another in a long row. The way a quantum computer works is it actually can do a huge number of very specialized sorts of computations simultaneously by manipulating an actual superposition of quantum states.
Right.
That currently is something that largely exists as a academic result, except there have been some very, very simple quantum computers constructed just for laboratory testing purposes.
I've read of some work going on in this area at Los Alamos National Laboratories recently that talks about entanglement.
Mm-hmm. That's the one of the concepts behind a quantum computer.
Right. What is superposition of quantum states?
It's a little bit hard to explain in
lay terms.
People who are used to sort of the world of large objects.
Yes, but I've studied Richard Feynman enough to be comfortable with it at least. What is a superposition exactly?
So it's the concept that you can have something like a electron or a photon, which is in many different places at once,
okay,
all simultaneously.
So superposition is being in two places or more at once.
That's a very rough approximation.
Conceptually, right. Okay.
And you can mathematically describe things like the densities at which it's in various superpositions,
right,
or the attributes of that.
This is really an offshoot of the probability that an electron is a probability field expressing that it's like where it, quote, is kind of a mathematical function and not a easily understandable large world object concept.
Exactly.
Okay. So, and superposition comes in to quantum computing because it's the position, it's the superpositions of the part of the electrons that are manipulated in order to do the changes that reflect the mathematical processes that are being mirrored?
Yeah, that's a good summary that gives the gist of it.
Right, okay. So is this something that's happening at Los Alamos or other places? Is it going to, will we be able to buy one at Radio Shack anytime soon?
I'd probably give it 20 or 30 years before we even really know how it's
okay.
going to pan out.
And if it does pan out, what advantages will that create?
Well, so a quantum computer can actually do computations in a fundamentally faster way than a regular computer.
By orders of magnitude, you mean?
Yeah, and there are problems that a regular computer, where regular computers just bog down as the problem gets bigger and more complicated.
Right.
Whereas with a quantum computer, it doesn't get bogged down the same way. It's got faster or better asymptotic performance in many of these problems.
It's almost doing the computation in more dimensions than standard computing, if you could say that.
Yeah, that's right? A good description.
All right. Last question has some people in it, actually. You were a graduate of Stanford. David Dill is a professor at Stanford, and he's a leading opponent of DREs that don't have photo-verified paper trails with them. There's an endorsement on your site from Professor Hellman, who I'm guessing was your mentor at Stanford and is now chairman of some department there. And Lawrence Lessig hangs out at the law school talking about fair use and new forms of copyright. Is Stanford the hotbed of both of these issues that we've been talking about, cryptography and fair use and all of the related issues that are coming up?
Well, I think Stanford's a wonderful place, and as a alumnus of the school, I think I'm supposed to say that it's a place where absolutely everything interesting is going on.
All right.
When it comes to cryptography, there are a lot of really good people there, also people like
Not to mention, of course, Yahoo and Google.
But it's certainly not the only place where good work and good research is being done.
Okay, and some of it, I'm sure, is being done at Cryptographic Research, Inc., where you are and where you're president, and I want to thank you for talking to us about it today.
Thank you very much. It's been great talking to you.
And we'll look forward to seeing what happens in this ongoing effort between those who've got the media and those that want the media. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye.